Dear Greg, as I mentioned in prior correspondence, in consideration of the upcoming celebration of Leibniz on the 300th anniversary of his death, I've immersed myself in his work, reading and rereading his texts as much as time allows. His oeuvre is so voluminous that I fear even by the time we meet in November, I will have only scratched the surface. I've been enjoying the fact that much of Leibniz's writings are in the form of letters. They are less precious, less formal in that way. As I prepare to write the piece for the celebration in Turin, I thought it would be nice to set my correspondence with you to music, as musical letters or studies of sorts. Ideas not yet fully formalized, but worth expressing, both the text and the accompanying music. I write this letter as an exposition of my preliminary reactions in hopes that the very articulation and expression of these thoughts will aid in their future formulation, albeit as naive as they may be in their current state. In Leibniz's writings, I found several cogent threads that intrinsically, if not explicitly, relate to art and music. I will group them as follows, even though they are all interrelated. Combinatorics, harmony, aesthetics, structure, epistemological versus practical limits, and free will. 1. Combinatorics. I found Leibniz's dissertation entitled On the Art of Combinations of particular interest, perhaps because it is an early work, laden with mistakes, yet sound in its conception. But more likely because of explicit references to the application of combinatorics to music. Although it was written for his studies in jurisprudence, it is humbling that it can apply to so many other domains. My composer friend Tom Johnson first showed me the 6 of 12 problems from the dissertation last summer, though I was unaware of the source at the time. In the problem, Leibniz tries to count the number of 6-note melodies that can be sung with 7 possible pitches. He classifies them by the number of repeated elements. That is, he was trying to give a solution for the number of tuples and permutations with prescribed repetitions. Earlier in the dissertation, he also discusses the application of combinations from problems 1 and 2 to organ registry, and counts the number of possible timbres that an organ with a certain number of stops can sound, i.e., all subsets of the stops. In this sense, Leibniz predicted over 300 years ago musical explorations that are only now being explored by composers more thoroughly. Though there are important precedents, bell ringing traditions come to mind, and also the music of Bach, of course. I like to think that there was a sort of intellectual resonance between Leibniz and Bach based on the fact that they lived near each other at the same time. I'm also curious if Bach might have been alluding to the title of Leibniz's dissertation, The Art of Fugue. To find a full version of Leibniz's letter to Christian Goldbach, I have found the following translated excerpts. Quote, all our usual intervals are ratios based on 2 of the prime numbers, 1, 2, 3, and 5. If we were endowed with a little more subtlety, we might arrive at the prime number 7, and actually, I believe the following ones are also given. Thus, the ancients did not openly avoid the number 7. Hardly anybody proceeded as far as the following prime numbers, 11 and 13, end quote. Then later in the letter he writes, quote, I do not believe that irrational ratios are pleasing to the souls in themselves, except when they are very close to the rational ones which give pleasure, end quote. Clearly Leibniz had a keen understanding of musical harmony. These are deep insights rooted in the Greeks, yet only revived recently by composers such as Harry Partch and James Tenney. And indeed, as Leibniz predicted, composers are starting to more thoroughly explore harmonies based on higher prime numbers, what Tenney calls extended harmonic spaces with higher dimensions. The second quotation might refer to the interleaving of dissonances with consonances, as is common suggesting what Tenney calls tuning tolerance, the idea that the brain resolves rational harmonies to the nearest simplest set of frequency ratios. Admittedly, I've yet to follow this thread in Leibniz's writings to further extent, but hope that I can find more texts that refer to harmony and harmonic constructs. 3. Aesthetics. It is hard to fully understand Leibniz's thoughts on the perception of beauty. He often alludes to the concepts of good and bad with respect to music and art, which I disagree with. In my mind, absolute beauty does not exist. People who believe in it are actually referring to status quo. That is, if someone deems something as universally bad, it simply means that it falls out of their understanding of a status quo opinion with which they are in agreement. Whether or not, or how, someone appreciates beauty must be subjective, even though status quo opinions will arise, especially within cultures. I've theorized in the past what can bring about a person's opinions with respect to if and how they appreciate something they perceive, and why this can differ from person to person. I can even demonstrate it in terms of algorithmic information theory, but I will leave that for a later time and remain focused for now on where Leibniz and I align. In both his discourse on metaphysics, as well as meditations on knowledge, truth, and ideas, Leibniz discusses the concepts of clear and confused knowledge. The latter is of particular interest to me. To paraphrase Leibniz with my understanding of the concept, confused knowledge is the ability to perceive something as distinguished from other things, yet unable to express the properties which give rise to its distinction. I sometimes tell people that music often interests me when I know that there is some underlying process, even though I cannot identify or properly articulate exactly what that process is. I refer to this as the incalculability of concept to percept transparency, which is the inability in art to know which extent someone can deduce the concept of a work from the perception or experience of it. Discussion on the relation of parts to other parts and to the whole, an example of which I will give later with respect to epistemological versus practical limits, is almost found verbatim in the composer John Cage's definition of structure. However, Leibniz had even more radical thoughts pertaining to structure. As you have pointed out in your own writing, Leibniz basically predicts algorithmic information theory with the following quotation from his discourse on metaphysics. Quote, "If someone traced a continuous line, which is sometimes straight, sometimes circular, and sometimes of another nature, it is possible to find a notion, or rule, or equation common to all the points of this line. When a rule is extremely complex, what is in conformity with it passes for irregular. But God has chosen the most perfect world, that is, the one which is at the same time the simplest in hypothesis and the richest in phenomena." This statement is essentially synonymous with the fundamental tenet of algorithmic information theory, that you have structure if the computer program that generates a given object is smaller in bits than the object itself. It is this idea, perhaps more than others, that I would like to follow as thoroughly as possible in Leibniz's work to better understand its genesis. 5. Epistemological versus practical limits. In the dissertation, Leibniz writes, quote, "The concept of parts is this. Given a plurality of beings, all of which are understood to have something in common, then, since it is inconvenient or impossible to enumerate all of them every time, one name is thought of which takes the place of all the parts in our reason, to make the expression shorter. This is called the whole. But in any number of given things, whatever, even infinite, we can understand what is true of all, since we can enumerate them all individually, at least in an infinite time. It is therefore permissible to use one name in our reasoning in place of all, and this will itself be a whole." End quote. Similar to how Leibniz was interested in an alphabet of human thought, in a lexicon of a universal language, it is inconvenient to enumerate through all subject-predicate pairs for a universal language, so too is it difficult, if not altogether impossible, to enumerate all possible musics made from a given set of elements. I often find that the musical concepts that I envision in the compositional process quickly spiral out of control, in the same way that their more abstract mathematical analogs in combinatorics explode exponentially. But where does the inspiration come that guides the artist to limit the material and order in a particular way? Here Leibniz's faith in God guides him. Much of his work references the perfection of God's creation, and the dissertation itself starts with a proof of God's existence. But this is all in search of truth, and clearly he is seeding the idea of a universal proof checker. This is yet another thing that amazes me about his thought process. Almost as asides, he embeds new fields of mathematics, or prophesizes concepts that are only proved or disproved much later. This rift between the limits of knowledge and the limits of practicality also occurs in algorithmic information theory. Beyond the paradox of not being able to find a minimal program with certainty, just finding a program that outputs a given result at all is exhaustive beyond our computing means today. I dream of a world in which all my ideas would be computable. I discuss above also gives me a great deal of faith in intuition and inspiration, and that my intuitive decisions are the very computations I am interested in making in machines. But what is choice? Leibniz believes that all true predicates are contained within a given subject. This is yet another idea where Leibniz and I have independently aligned, if I interpret his thoughts correctly. I believe he suggests that because you are unaware of the future, despite its containment in the subjects of the world, that whether or not there is free will does not matter. I have referred to this as the illusion of choice in my own writing, and suggests that the very same thing I interpret in Leibniz, that in any world, determinate or not, there is no difference between choice and the illusion of choice. Just as art is a confused knowledge, so too is love. My body and my senses inform me of its presence and of its loss from another, but my mind cannot explain the reasons for these visceral distinctions. I imagine Leibniz has somewhere discussed, but I now understand, that all I do is for love, and that every ounce of my creative energy is for that love to be reciprocated.